The other word I kind of kept coming across was a bit perplexing as well. I think it's a little bit strange, actually, in places. And some of the things that Paul seems to be saying, I found quite difficult. Right at the very beginning, right at the start in verse 2, Paul is accusing the Jews or his people of having zeal but lacking knowledge. Okay, in the translation I normally use, it says they're not enlightened. Okay, he's saying that his people are not enlightened. Okay, and I think that the sort of themes that Paul then moves on to explore seem to me to revolve around things like knowledge versus ignorance, faith versus works, the righteousness of God versus self righteousness. That's coming out particularly, I think, in verse 3. So there's something about a wrong approach to God versus a right approach to God. And I just want to prefix what I'm where I'm going to kind of go this evening, just by thinking back to the writer, Paul, and just to sort of remember, really, that Paul was not always called Paul. He used to be called Saul. He used to be Saul. And Saul was very different to Paul. Okay. Saul was actually a vicious persecutor of the Christians. He was against the Christians. He met with Jesus and he was actually blinded in his encounter. And shortly afterwards, his sight was restored. So the blind Saul has become the seeing Paul. Okay, and I just want to kind of come back to that idea from time to time. Okay. So I've mentioned as that seems to think about knowledge, faith, and approach, and those are the three sort of words that I want to kind of bear in mind, really, or sort of structure the talk around. Okay. Just going to check what time it is, because you don't want to be here all night, do you? Okay, 10 to 7. Right. So a lack of knowledge, that's kind of Paul's diagnosis, if you like, at the beginning. That's where the trouble lies. And to be honest with you, instantly, I am suspicious. I am suspicious, okay. And I think to myself, well, how can a lack of knowledge be so terrible? How can kind of not knowing something be all that bad? And I think, sort of reading this through, there's a bit of me that kind of tends to possibly not value knowledge all that terribly highly. Personally, I tend to think I'd rather meet a person that's rich in love than a person that's rich in knowledge. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Okay. I do actually think there's something in that. Okay. I think probably love is more important than knowing stuff. Okay. Paul himself says knowing stuff has this propensity to puff people up. And that's no good, is it? We don't want to be puffed up. Okay. Romans 10 is really hard. It's really difficult. It's quite obscure. In places, maybe you could say it's even unclear. Okay. So would we not be better looking at something a bit more straightforward, a bit easier? Okay. Why try and absorb some sort of deep knowledge? Why not go for something clearer or something that would inspire us to love more directly? Okay. But I think there's a problem creeping in there when we start to think in those kinds of ways. Okay. Because it's actually very close to saying this bit of scripture over here is more useful than this bit of scripture over there. Do you see that? Yeah. Okay, it's kind of picking, choosing, isn't it? Okay. And that's dangerous because then we are on the journey towards kind of setting ourselves up in judgment of God's word, in judgment of his revelation to us. So turning away from harder scriptures is not a good thing. It's also a little bit like kind of saying, well, thanks God, but I don't really want to know anymore. Don't really want to know anymore, because I know enough, thank you. I know enough. There's not really a lot more useful stuff you can show me. And none of you would ever want to be caught thinking that, would you? No. No. Okay. So I think kind of the point about knowledge is it's not bad in itself. There is nothing wrong with knowledge. But it's only useful in proportion to which it takes us deeper into Jesus. Okay? So the purpose of knowledge is to carry us into him and to carry others into him, deeper into him, which is deeper into love. Okay. So that's all sounds great, but what does that actually look like? And that's a really important question. Is it so important I actually need to take a swig of water before I even try and answer it? It is an important question. And what was the question? Oh, yeah, it was, what does love look like? Okay. Well, I think love is revealed, isn't it, when it helps other people. Okay. We see love blessing other people. We see love giving to other people. I think giving is a really core aspect of the life of the Spirit. The person of the Spirit is a giving, blessing person. So we need to find ways of using our knowledge to bless others, to give to them, to build them up, to restore them. Perhaps we should be thinking of knowledge in terms of how we can use it to help people on that journey from becoming Saul, who is blind, to becoming Paul, who can see. Okay, that kind of brings us back really to this question of seeing. And that's maybe one of the most loving applications of our knowledge, to help others see Jesus, to help others discover him, or perhaps to help other people rediscover him. Okay, and helping others to see is what I think Paul is trying to do in Romans 10. I think he's trying to help people see Jesus. Okay, so he's actually modeling the proper use of knowledge. He's helping people even now, even today, to see Jesus. And actually, his heart is breaking, I think, with the desire for his own people to see Jesus, for the Jews to see Jesus. So he's got this immense, formidable, colossal knowledge, hasn't it? But it's all broken. It's all broken up in love for the people that he holds most dear. And I think that's a very beautiful illustration of knowledge used properly. Okay. So I just said that Paul's trying to help us see. Okay. A cynical person might say, well, he didn't make much of a job of it, did he? Because it's a bit obscure, it's a bit peculiar. And I think it'd be a little bit hard to answer that, to be honest with you. But I just want to pick out one little bit of this passage using this idea of seeing Jesus. Okay. It's verses 5 to 8, and it's a rather peculiar bit about bringing Christ down and pulling Christ up. Okay. I was kind of attracted to that because it was one of the bits that made me kind of think, ooh, what? What's that about? And again, this what I'm going to share is just a, you know, it's an attempt. It's one person. What I drew from it, it's not necessarily the only thing that God has to say to us through the scripture. Okay, I'm kind of beginning to think now more about faith. I've been thinking of knowledge, but I think the emphasis is shifting to faith. Okay, so in this little section, verses 5 to 8, I think Paul is kind of re-seeing or rediscovering part of the book of Deuteronomy in chapter 30. Okay, a lot of it is actually a quote from that. Okay. I just want to hit on the context of where we're at in Deuteronomy 30. Okay, so the Israelites are gathered all together at Moab. They're under Moses. Okay, and they're right on the very edge of going into the promised land. Okay, they've had all these blessings foretold to them for many, many years, and they're right just about to enter into it, kind of thing. And Moses is looking ahead to the future. Okay, he's looking ahead to what's going to happen. And he's kind of warning and exhorting the Israelites to stay faithful. Okay, so the bit in Deuteronomy, not in Romans, the bit that Paul's using reads along these lines. Surely this commandment that I'm commanding you today is not too hard for you, nor is it too far away. It's not in heaven that you should say, who will go up to heaven for us and get it for us so that we may hear it and observe it. Neither is it beyond the sea that you should say, who will cross to the other side of the sea for us and get it for us so that we may hear it and observe it? No, the word is very near to you. It's in your mouth and in your heart for you to observe. Okay, seeing and not seeing. What might Saul, before he became Paul, have made of that? I think he probably would have read it as an exhortation to get on with it. He would have seen the kind of the simplicity in the law, the common sense nature of the law. He'd have seen its beauty. He would have heard something like, get on with this, do this and live. Do this and live. You can do this. And I think his heart would probably sing back in response, yeah, I'll do it. I'll do it. I'll do it. Okay. But Paul is different, isn't he? Paul is in the middle of this great, big, gigantic, unfolding sort of process of rediscovering everything about his past, his history, his tradition, himself, his heart. Okay, and he sees Jesus within these scriptures. It's Jesus who ascends into heaven. Jesus who descends into the depths. Okay, he sees Jesus doing the impossible. And Jesus making the impossible possible for us. He sees Jesus putting life within our reach, and not just our reach, but everybody's reach, Jew and Gentile alike. He sees Jesus taking the law that had brought death and turning it into life. Okay, and here he is, it's Jesus. He sees Jesus wrapped up in the words, in between the lines of these very ancient texts from the book of Deuteronomy. He sees Jesus being revealed. He sees Jesus opened up to the whole world. He sees Jesus transforming everything, changing everything, making everything new. He doesn't see an exhortation to work harder. Okay. Paul can see through these verses from the Old Testament, that everything that God does through people occurs through faith in Jesus. He sees that apart from him, we can do nothing, literally nothing. That the real work of God is kind of born out of the intimacy of the Spirit who lives in us, in our hearts. Okay, it's him who does it, it's not us. That's how it's always been, even in Moses' day. I think that's what Paul sees in these verses. Okay. So Paul kind of has eyes of faith. Okay. He's both seeing, he's seeing Jesus revealed within the ancient scriptures, but he's also trying to help others to see. So there's some kind of connection, I think, between faith and seeing. Faith sees Jesus. Faith gets the point. But what about approach? Okay, that's the third of my words, isn't it? It was approach. What characterizes a faith-filled approach to God? I think there are some clues in Romans 10. I'm going to actually tie up a little bit with some bits and pieces from Luke to try and answer that, Luke's gospel. I'm just sort of thinking of Luke 7, okay? Right at the very beginning, there's some a story about a centurion. He's possibly a Roman, but my sort of Google searching and books and stuff tell me that that's a little bit doubtful, and we don't necessarily know whether he's a Roman or not. Okay. One thing is pretty certain, though. He wouldn't have been a Jew. Okay. He was part of the occupying, invading army. He was a symbol, in a sense, of all of Israel's enemies. He's a symbol of everything that opposes God. In a sense, he is a natural enemy to God. Everything that opposes Jesus. Okay. Also, we might think that. But actually, he's commended for his great faith. In fact, Jesus says this guy's got more faith than anyone he's ever met, even in Israel. He's got more faith than the Jews. But how can that be? Because he's on the wrong side, isn't he? He's on the wrong side, but he's got more faith than the guys that are on the right side. Now, I think this kind of thing, if you look for it, happens all the time in the New Testament. Happens all the time. Okay, the people who should be missing it turn out to be the ones that Jesus esteems the most. Okay, the people you'd think would miss it turn out to be the ones that get it. Happens all the time. You may have noticed towards the end of the reading, Paul's quoting from Isaiah. He says, I've been found by those who didn't seek me. People who weren't even looking, they got it. They found me. And the opposite happens as well. It's vice versa. The ones who you would think on paper ought to be getting the point straight away, the ones who have all the advantages, the ones who have all the privileges, all the learning, all the rest of it, they seem to fall into difficulty with Jesus. They incur his anger. Okay. You may have noticed at the end of Romans 10 there, verse 21, again, there's an Isaiah quote, held out my hands, but you're disobedient. You didn't get it. God is holding out his hands, but they don't get it. Okay. I want to just pick up a section of this story. When he, the centurion, heard about Jesus, he sent some Jewish elders to him, asking to come and heal his slave. When they came to Jesus, they appealed to him earnestly, saying, he's worthy of having you do this for him, for he loves our people, and it's he who built our synagogue for us. And Jesus went with them. But when he was not far from the house, the centurion sent friends to say to them, Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I'm not worthy to have you come under my roof. Therefore, I did not presume to come to you, but only speak the word and let my servant be healed. I just want to think about two points from that about the centurion. Remember, we're thinking about approach, aren't we? Thinking about approach to God. Okay, the first thing is, and it hits you in the face, doesn't it, is profound sense of unworthiness. His sense of unworthiness. Okay, first of all, he gets some elders to go and speak to Jesus because he doesn't consider himself worthy of making an approach directly. And then right at the last moment, he actually bottles out. Okay, he bottles out and gets some friends to come and tell Jesus not to come. He can't face Jesus. He can't face him. I think he's too aware. He's too painfully aware of the gulf that exists between himself and Jesus. Okay, face-to-face encounters too much for him. And that's actually despite his friend's insistence that he's a good guy. Did you notice how willing his mates were to boast about him? Oh, he's done all this cool stuff. He deserves it. He's not doing any boasting himself, is he? Oh no, quite the opposite. Okay. The other thing is his compassion for the slave. Okay. I just want to remember that in the context and culture we're looking at, a slave has absolutely no status at all, okay? They've got no recourse to legal protection, so they're not protected by law, okay? The word doesn't mean anything. In fact, the only time a slave's word, I think this is right, is Rowan Williams, so it's got to be right. The only time a slave's word was admissible in any sort of legal proceeding was if it had been got out of them by torture. If they hadn't been tortured, it wasn't worth anything. Okay. And even then, a non-slave, a free person, still had greater weight legally. Okay. The narrative doesn't even give the slave a gender, does it? We don't know if it's him or her. The slave just has a label, slave. Okay. But this slave, this non-person almost, this sort of dehumanized human, is being cared for, isn't he? He's being dignified. He's being humanized. He's being wanted. He's being loved. It's a slave being loved. And we often focus on the centurion's assurance of his power, of Jesus' power, don't we? Just say the word. Okay, but I wonder if it's just as much the centurion's compassion and love for his slave that actually evidences his faith as well. Because that was very unusual, I think, in that time. Okay. And throughout the New Testament, okay, there's often a link between this person's sense of unworthiness, almost shame, I think, in Jesus' presence, and the response that they receive from him. And it's made it even more explicit, I think, in another illustration from Luke, this time from Luke 18, where Jesus contrasts a very righteous tax collector with a very self-righteous Pharisee. Okay, they both come to a temple, but the tax collector can't approach. Just like the centurion, he can't approach. He can't look up. He stands at a distance. Okay. In the text, he actually hits himself, batters himself, and says, "God, have mercy on me, a sinner." He feels unworthy. But it's actually, this tax collector is actually doing something right. Okay, he's approaching Jesus on the basis of faith, because he knows that everything he's done in the past, everything he's doing at the moment, and actually everything he's going to do in this life, is not going to get him there, is it? Because it's drenched in sin, and he knows it. Okay, he knows it. It's the same with us. Okay, we dare not approach God on the basis of works, what we're going to do, what I'm going to do for you one day, God. Oh no, don't go flying at God with an attitude like that. Okay. He asks for mercy, and that's the same with us. We approach him on the basis of asking for mercy. Okay. The Pharisee's the opposite. So he's confident, isn't he, of God's favor. And he tells God all the good things he does. In the text, it says, "I fast twice a week and I give a tenth of all I get." Ooh, isn't that cool? Okay, he's trying to approach God based on works, trying to approach God based on what he does. And the tragedy is that he has absolutely no idea that God is rejecting his advance. Okay, he's so immersed in what he's doing, in his own feelings, his own estimation of himself, that he's ignorant, literally without knowledge of his real spiritual state. Okay, it's all dressed up, isn't it, in religious language. All dressed up in kind of following the law and doing the right thing and being seen with the right people. Okay, all dressed up in religion. That's a very powerful caution to us. It's all dressed up in religion. Okay, but he actually can't see the peril that he's in. Okay. And in a sense, particularly as a Pharisee, which is a very strict Jew, the same as Paul, he kind of stands in a way for the Jews and possibly, I think, for the kind of attitude maybe that Paul is thinking of at the beginning of Romans 10. Okay. So it's the tax collector whom God esteems, not the Pharisee. They are both helpless, but one sees it, one knows it, and the other one doesn't. One can see, the other can't. So faith involves seeing. That's a facet of real faith. It's a kind of inner brokenness that says, "Have mercy on me. Have mercy on me." Okay. And that, I think, takes us back to Paul's accusation, doesn't it, about being unenlightened, I think. It's that difference of approach. Okay. So that he's saying that the Jews don't lack facts or information, but it's self-knowledge. And again, it's the same for us. We need to truly see how things stand with us within our relationships. We need to see others. We need to see what I've called the dignity of the fingerprint of the divine within others. Okay. And when we see that, I think we also see the harm that we can do in our sin when we sin against others. Okay, we need to have that cost, that dehumanizing cost of our sin inflicted on others. We need to be able to see that, even on the least, even on the slaves, the ones that don't even have a gender, the ones we flinch from, the ones that have done bad things, the ones we find very easy to ignore. Okay. Faith enables us to see people. Okay, so it's a blessing, but it can sometimes inspire grief. Okay. And just finally, to a nod to Luke, there's a place in Luke 6 where Jesus says, "Blessed are those who weep." He kind of inverts that idea of those that mourn should be ones that are to be pitied, but he says, "Blessed are those who weep." And I wonder if part of the thinking underneath that, or part of that, is about the sense of faith igniting in us a sensitivity to others, and therefore a kind of sense of shame about the things that we've done to others, that we do to others. So what have I been saying? So first, that one aspect of the mystery of faith is the knowledge that we can't face God on our own terms. Okay. Then I was saying that essentially faith should help us love others better. Faith should help us dignify others better. Okay. And finally, that we should be eager to learn new things, but also eager to kind of apply that knowledge to help others, to wash others' feet, to help them see better. Okay, thank you.